You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to physical comedian The Boy with Tape on His Face, who has got a 5-star review from pretty much every critic out there. And shortly after this interview was recorded live at the Edinburgh Festival, he went on to win the panel prize at the Edinburgh Comedy Awards. So here he removes the tape to talk to us in person as his alter ego, Mr. Sam Wills.
Shake a thing. Have a seat. And do take that out of the thing if you'd like to.
Dun, dun, dun.
Ah. How you doing? What's it like being on stage without the tape?
Talking to an audience.
Yeah, look, there they are. Look at their faces. Look at their hungry eyes. You have to say things now.
Yeah, and ruining it with a New Zealand accent.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Did anyone know that Sam was from New Zealand? Oh, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it weird?
Some people think I'm French because I wear stripes and play accordion music.
Did you think, hands up, who thought he was French? Did you really? was it the stripes?
It's the hair.
It's the hair. Yeah. It is. It's pretty French hair. Mm. Did you say
Tintin?
Tintin, I believe, was Belgian. Yeah. Obviously.
Europe.
As opposed to a Kiwi, it's all basically the same, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely.
Thank you very much for coming here. I should explain, Sam is an old friend of mine. We've been buddies from the street performing days.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting to have you on the show. I worry sometimes when I have people on who I know really well that we don't get to see each other very much. All I want to do is sit here and go, how's it going?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, everyone. But it's lovely to see you. Thanks for coming on. Let's talk about The Boy with Tape on His Face. I think, has everyone here seen it? Or you haven't?
No.
You're just seekers after mystery. Fantastic. Okay, tell us what the ending of the show is. No, don't really. So just to explain to these people then what you see the act as being.
The Boy with Tape on His Face is essentially a stand-up comedy show where I won't talk for an entire hour. I gaffer-tape my mouth shut, and so I wear a kind of throwback to a mime costume with a stripy...
Sort of French.
Yeah,
French
stripy. Stripey top, grey jeans and a little blazer, and I carry a satchel full of props, and on stage I've got cardboard boxes full of everyday objects that I use in different ways, and I have a lot of audience participation. So I get people out of the audience and I turn them into different, sometimes puppets, sometimes I'll get them to do little jobs on stage, and they help complete scenes, and I use music a lot to create the punchlines mostly.
Yeah, I love the idea of getting people on stage and get them to do little jobs.
Jobs.
You sort of sounded a bit like a Doctor Who villain, like I turned them into puppets. And in fact, our lovely sound tech, Misha, was a bit scared of you coming on the show today. She finds the
audience.
She finds the well, no, she finds the act. She finds you with gaffer tape to be a little bit frightening. It does have that sort of edge.
I can see how it does have a sort of hostage connotation to it.
It
is pretty scary, I suppose.
And also the style visually, it's kind of like a French sort of Tim Burton.
Isn't it? It has that
kind of...
Well, the Tim Burton influence is massive because I'm from that era of growing up with Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and loving all of those films.
Very much
the earlier work, the more recent stuff. And even the name itself, The Boy with Tape on His Face, comes from a collection of poems by Tim Burton, which is...
Is it really?
Well, Tim Burton wrote a book called The Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy.
And, yes, okay.
And there was a story called the Boy with Nails in His Eyes, which was a little short poem about a boy who had nails in his eyes who put up a Christmas tree, and he couldn't see it, but to him it was beautiful. And I thought it was really, really sweet, this idea that you can't see something, but it's still nice. So then I took the boy, and it's very literal as well, so the boy with tape on his face,
yeah.
The boy who can't speak, who wants to say a lot.
Did you try, was there like months worth of rehearsal with nails in your eyes before you went, it's just not working?
You know about nails.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah. I should explain as well, Sam being a dirty little street performing carny, you were also, I mean, you started off, did you start off hammering nails up your nose, or what was your start? Yeah, that's a real thing. Yeah,
the odd progression for me was I started off doing magic. That was my first love, was doing magic tricks. So I got a magic set when I was a kid. Then from magic I found a clown who taught me to do some clowning stuff. So I learned to ride a unicycle and learned juggling. Then I became obsessive compulsive about juggling, where I dropped out of school to juggle more. My parents made me learn every aspect of juggling. I went to a
your parents made, when you went, well, I'm bailing this for juggling, they went, well, then you're bloody doing juggling.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah, okay. If you want to learn to juggle professionally, then know everything about juggling. So I had to learn that there were the six basics, kind of clubs, balls, rings, diablos, devil stick and cigar boxes. So I had to research the history of those six items and then understand where they came from and then also master them and know exactly how to use them and then learn the outskirts of juggling, from contact juggling, kendamas, to, and then going into unicycles, stilt walking, tightrope walking, and then went to circus school where I studied more. So we did a small amount of trapeze, acrobatics, and I did more juggling. Juggling was still my main passion at that time. Mm-hmm. And then from juggling, it was the I got interested in circus sideshow. I met a sword swallower. And that was kind of it.
Which sword swallower did you
Hefty
meet?
Jeff.
Hefty Jeff. And, with a Kiwi accent, that's particularly funny, isn't
Jeff.
It? It's Hefty Jeff, isn't it?
But he used to swallow swords and various knives and samurai size. But his thing was he could swallow an electric bread knife going, which was...
Oh, wow. That's
amazing.
Great. That's great, isn't it? That's lovely. I love the way circus tricks work like that. We've both got a lot of experience in that kind of world. And, you know, the first time you see Space Cowboy swallow a neon tube that lights his neck up. I saw a guy at Glastonbury a few years ago juggling tasers with the handles gaffer taped down. So juggling live tasers. Oh, it's just
brilliant.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You take that kind of imagination and go, okay.
Yeah.
And that's sort of very similar to the way... to the way you work now, isn't it? I mean, we'll come back to that in a second, because I'm enjoying this putting you in context.
The oddity of... and so from Hefty Jeff, after seeing some of the odd things that he did, I started learning the circus sideshow stunt. So the first one I learned was the human blockhead, which is the nail up nose. So I learned that by taking cold spaghetti and snorting it up my nose and coughing it out my mouth so I could find where the sinus passage was.
Yeah.
And then I took a 4-inch nail...
You realise they're going to sell their tickets now.
Yes,
they're not coming anymore.
Then I took the 4-inch nail and put it inside one of those modelling balloons. So that way it acted like a kind of condom for a nail. I covered it in olive oil so it wasn't going to cut me in any way, shape or form, and just sort of slowly prodded it around until I found exactly where it needed to go. And then I got used to that, and then I started just doing the nail regularly, and then I upgraded.
And so when you say doing the nail, what you're describing is you get a 4-inch nail, and you tap it with a hammer until it goes into your head.
Tap with a nail into the face. And then in that show I would be getting a female volunteer out of the audience whose job was to prove the nail was real. I'd hammer it in and then she would have to pull it out with her teeth.
That's, you see, now, was that your own twist on it, the teeth?
Twist,
because it's a fairly common act. The human blockhead is a sort of standard trick, but it's taking the idea of a common thing, and that's a beautiful tweak on it, isn't it? To get someone to get close enough to pull it out with their teeth. That's beautiful.
Then I'd take it another step further because I practiced more so I could learn to do it with a power drill.
Yes, okay.
So I would then get the female volunteer to hold the power drill, so it was her responsibility, and I would lower my face onto it.
Wow. So the noise there was someone being sick in the background, just for the sake of the recording.
Yeah.
Wowzers. Okay.
And then, going on from that.
So what kind of context were you performing these things in? Did you do the power drill in a street show, in a cabaret show? What was the...
I was kind of doing it on the street, but not very successfully.
Okay.
Because audiences would walk away.
You couldn't find a... I was going to say, also, you're difficult to find a socket.
Yeah. But the street shows I was doing were very crude, kind of juggling fire and standing. I think for one of my shows, my earlier street show, I used to juggle 3 fire clubs, standing on a chair, wearing a full body condom, because I thought that would be the safety thing. It was a terrible street show. And then I was doing that for a wee bit, and then I evolved to standing on raw eggs, juggling fire. It was always juggling fire, because that was the thing for the street. I was very much a... early street performer. And then from there, got into comedy accidentally because Jared Christmas was the reason.
Yes, I was talking comedy. To Jared the other night about
He rang me once with a kind of panic because a comedian cancelled last minute. And so I got a phone call. We live in the same town in Christchurch. And he ran the only comedy club once a month. And he rang me saying, one of the comics is cancelled. Can I come down and do some tricks? And it was like, well, what can I do? Can I do some fire? And he went, no, it's inside. Yeah. So I just sort of bungled in a whole bunch of tricks and sort of said, can I do this? And he went, you just get up there and do 10 minutes. And so I just went on stage with a suitcase and just went, here's me hammering a nail at my nose. Da, da, da. All right, okay, next trick, here's this. Do you want to see me do this? Da, da. And that then became my style of hyping an audience up. Do you want to see this? Say, yeah, yeah, all right.
Yeah, yeah, this. Yeah.
And so it became...
So that was before, so you'd done some street shows.
I'd done a tiny amount
of street. But you didn't have a circle show
I hadn't had really nailed a street show properly. I hadn't mastered exactly how to do.
No pun intended.
I hadn't actually figured out the science of a street show. So then when I went indoors, I had what I thought was the understanding of how street performing worked, and then I applied that to on stage to comedy. So I didn't have a stand-up comedy base and I didn't have a street show base, but I knew roughly how they both worked. Mm-hmm. And then I made this little format of my own of high energy prop comedy. So I would just go on stage and go, here's 30 or 40 tricks done in 20 minutes very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so that way the audiences were just overloaded. Then by the end of it, I'd go off. So it was a tough act to follow because the stage was always covered in crap.
There's leaves of nails sticking out like caltrops. There we go, follow that.
But also because the audience, I'd learnt on stage doing that show how to control an audience and how to hype them up and make them sort of respond in that way.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that would seem to put you in the same category as a fair amount of street performers who've brought their stuff indoors.
Yeah.
So what was the next stage? What was it that, I mean, then you went into doing...
Then I started doing 1 hour solo shows because I was just doing 20 minute spots and 15 minute spots in comedy clubs. And then from there, I started writing my own 1 hour shows. And the first real, I wrote an adult show called The Prince of Cringe, which was based on a fairy tale using these circus sideshow stunts.
Yeah.
And it didn't go very well. Years later, I realized I wrote a kids show. It wasn't meant for adults.
Okay, I remember The Prince of Cringe as a children's show. Yes,
yeah,
okay.
So I sort of tweaked and changed for kids later. But then I started writing, I just kind of felt like this dancing monkey. So the first real successful show I had was a show called Dance Monkey Dance, mm-hmm. which was kind of like an autobiographical show about my life growing up as a kid, learning magic tricks, becoming a clown, going to circus school and various whatnot.
And so did that have a spoken element to it, if it was about those things?
Yeah.
Was it trick-led?
I started the show with like a 10-minute comedy spot to hype the audience up and then go, thank you very much, good night. And then I would pack up on stage and then just sort of acknowledge the audience and then discuss. Normally people leave at this point because my job is done. And then it would become a backstory on here's, you know, and it was just a narrative quiet story. There were some incredibly quiet, sad moments in it as well. And it was incredibly honest as well, which was by the end of the show, people were going, there was that connection of saying how, because I do another trick where I put the rubber glove on my head and I blow it up with my nose. Mm-hmm. And I sort of told the audience, it's very silly.
It's not in the show.
Not in the show, yeah. I'd suffocate.
Yeah. It's a good job. It's a good job. You had that conversation with yourself before attempting that trick.
But I sort of had the conversation. I had the conversation with the audience, saying how the only question I ever get asked after a comedy show is, "Does it hurt when a glove pops on my head?" And I had that for years, and it was so. I kind of wanted to address that fact that nobody actually knew who I was. And so I did a whole show telling them, this is who I am. I studied a magic thing. I did this. So by the end of it, they were really, really invested in the whole show.
So did you find that no one knew who you were because the tricks were taking over?
Oh, absolutely.
If you were the person doing tricks, then they just saw the tricks and had no real interest in you.
I was very much a dancing monkey. The music would come on, I would do the tricks and then disappear.
And speaking of, I mean, we know a lot of dancing monkeys, don't we? And I'm not slagging them off. That's a thing that a lot of performers, I mean, I used to be a street performer on the Royal Mile. I can juggle and do a lot of that stuff myself, and I always used to find that very frustrating. My journey through that came gradually dropping all of the tricks, doing more and more talking in my street show, until I looked back and went, oh, I'm basically a stand-up comedian.
I'll go
inside and there won't be dogs. Yeah. There won't be e.g. dogs or rain, but the money will invert. That was born out of a sense of wanting to express yourself rather than simply go look at this trick.
Yeah, and then funnily enough, after I had spoken to an audience and expressed myself, I won an award for the show, which was wonderful. And at the time in New Zealand, it was the biggest comedy award. And so I got this thing, and then it was like, oh, great. Now there's the expectation for just to do more tricks and talking. So there was that feeling of, well, I've won and lost. That was the
point. Okay. Because it was like they were going, that's very good.
Yeah.
Do more tricks.
Well done, monkey.
Yeah, well done, monkey. Continue dancing.
Write
yeah.
another show.
Okay.
And so that was then the idea was to drop it all completely and to surprise everyone and do a silent show with no tricks. So that the plan came to devise a character. And so I had a little costume that I put together with a kind of scraggly shirt and, again, jacket and jeans, because I, at the time, didn't really probably own that much clothing.
Yeah.
And then I had a tape measure as a tie. I remember that. And I wandered on stage and did the act. And within the first sort of 30 seconds, the premise for the act was, I don't even know what the first gag was. I think the idea was to kind of do the mucking around with a microphone mm-hmm. business, and then I had one prop or something that I was going to play with and try and find an audience member to do something with a prop. But within the first 30 seconds, I just went straight into, good evening, how are you doing? That was it, because it was that panic of,
sure.
I'm way out of my comfort zone.
Yes.
And so in New Zealand, we're lucky enough to have only one comedy club. So I... got to ring the owner of the comedy club and say, can I come back and do it again? Went back, and then the tape kind of went onto my face more out of necessity, first time around.
Out of necessity to stop you from panicking and just going and doing sort of
generic
stuff.
Well, I could panic underneath the whole thing. I could still panic, but there's no option to... Which then became funnier, because it was that thing of hostage, I can't communicate to an audience.
Sure.
So I sort of made the decision that day to tape face, and then it was like, okay, if there's tape on my face, what would I need? I would need some scissors to take it off. So then I did... I rigged a set of scissors from the roof of the comedy club. So when I came on stage, I looked up and everyone saw the scissors. And then I did the milk crate stack, which is where you get milk crates and you sort of get them passed to you by a volunteer and you stack them higher and higher. And so I did that on stage. So I was still falling back on the street performing kind of nervousness hype, but trying to work on this character. And then when I got to the top of the milk crates, I pulled out of scissors out of my own pocket and cut them down. There's the gag.
Gotcha.
And that was the bit.
Okay. So in terms of, let's talk about that as an example. Where did that, let's talk about the process by which you found that gag, you found the funny in that. So it turns, like that stops simply being a milk crate balance.
Yeah.
And actually... it turns into a piece of physical comedy which happens to contain a circus trick.
Yeah.
And that's very much, you know, that was kind of, you can see there the genesis of the boy we take.
Yeah, that became my formula for a long time of just going, what is the trick? And then it did evolve into, because I was just using French music, there was no music. Then I discovered I didn't want to do these tricks. That was the thing. I had to drop the trick because I was just then being a dancing monkey with tape on my face. Mm-hmm. So then the idea was to, how can I do something that isn't a trick but can be led by something else? Because it was all just French background music for the whole set. So then I was listening to music at home, and then the music became my new tricks. So all of the music is very heavy in my show. So it'll be French accordion music or some sort of generic background stuff. And then when the joke comes, the music will switch into a very iconic bang. That's it. And the penny drop moments. So those were, they became my trick. So one of the earliest bits I wrote was the Unchained Melody ghost bit.
Yes. Can you describe that to us?
I get a female volunteer out of the audience. I have a bit of Play-Doh that I sit on top of a little plastic container, and then we stare at it awkwardly to French music. And so she doesn't know what's going on, and it's that confusion of, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you? And she doesn't know what's happening. Eventually, I put her hands into a position. I stand behind her. I grab her hands, and we touch the clay. The moment we touch the clay, it switches into Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. So they became the smaller tricks and punchlines that I started. That was my formula to start working to. Hear the music, find a track of music that I really like and go, there's something really funny in it. Or it became iconic. That was the thing.
Okay.
It had to be, all the music in my show has to be from the 80s and early 90s. I can't do anything from reasonably modern times.
Why is that rule? Why do you have that rule?
Because I want to have a nostalgia thing in my show, because I want to have, I want people when they're at the show to remember what it was like to be a kid and those feelings of, I remember when things were good. I remember that. So when you hear these songs, majority of the shows, some songs in the show are, you know, that feeling of...
There's, as well as getting the joke, you're also going, oh, I love this.
I haven't heard this for years. Hey.
Sure.
It's a little good.
Sure. So you're saying you would start with that particular piece, you started with the music. You
music
heard
first.
The Unchained Melody thing.
Unchained
you thought,
Melody
what could I do
song.
With that?
Yep. That just became generic. This is a good song. Put it into the iTunes playlist. And then that goes away.
So you end up with a huge playlist of stuff.
I've got a playlist of odd songs that I go, there's something funny in all of these.
I see.
Then I wander around shops. shops and see things and watch people. Like, I was listening to, I have the playlist occasionally that I have on Shuffle, and I'll be listening to it when I'm, you know, drinking coffees at cafes. The stripper routine, which is where I get a guy out of the audience to, I dress him up and he takes off his clothing. To the full Monty's, Tom Jones, You Can Leave Your Hat On. The only reason that came about was because I was in Christchurch listening to the playlist, and just as A Builder came around the corner, that song came on.
Okay.
And all I could think was, it would be amazing if he took his clothes off.
So you listen to music, you walk around shops, and you look at people. That's the creative process. Okay.
In a coat.
Yeah. Do you find, I mean, those, obviously it's easy for us to look back at those sort of examples, because those are very clear-cut ones.
Yep.
Can you give us an example of something that was harder, that didn't work? I mean, is it? Are there ever moments where you're staying up at night going, I can't make this work? Or does it all deliver itself in that?
I spend months on stuff. Like and my wife will testify to this, that I'd drive her crazy with these stupid things. Where I had it in my head for, months, that I thought a crossbow that shoots a plunger is incredibly funny.
Yes.
And so Mike Wood is another great street performer, and he, I knew, had a crossbow that could shoot a plunger. So I traded a set of bouncy stilts for his crossbow. So I got his crossbow. So now I had this prop, and I thought, okay, this is really good. Now I need to find a toaster that can shoot toast really high.
Yes.
So I found these guys who built a pneumatic toaster.
Okay.
And they could shoot at 30 feet. So I was
getting... I found these guys who built a pneumatic toaster. What a wonderful sentence, though.
Google.
Yeah.
Google.
Yeah,
sure. We'll find anything. So I Googled powerful toaster, and then from there found these guys who were setting Guinness World Records for shooting toast higher than the statues and whatnot. And so I managed to get them to come to one of my shows. They understood what I was doing, and then I talked to them about this idea. What I wanted to do was get a plunger, cover it in butter and jam,
and deliver a payload. Yeah.
Because another influence for what I do is cartoons, Wile E. Coyote and all that sort of stuff. I love all those classic cartoons, Looney Tunes and Hanna-Barbera, because I don't think cartoons these days are that good. So I love that silliness of building, constructing, and this ridiculous visual image. But this plunger was inconsistent, where to the point where I had to chop the plunger to put little things in to make it snag the thing to shoot, and it could shoot 30 feet. When it went, it was amazing. It was the back of the garden, ka-chunk, and it made such a great noise. And the plunger was so crude that it was built out of blocks of wood, so it didn't look like a crossbow. It was the type of thing you could assemble, and then only when you lifted it up, you went, oh my God, and it would kind of shake gently. But the problem was, when I would shoot it, every third go, the whole thing would explode.
Okay.
And that was funny, but the problem was I couldn't rely on that being a thing. So I worked on this for so long, going, this plunger, I have to shoot a plunger. This plunger's got to be the big thing. And then it just reached that point where I had to kind of confess to myself, this isn't funny. This is not working, and put it away. And then the plunger got put away. And
did you ever try it on stage? Were you performing with it?
No.
I took it into the...
I tend not to do anything on stage unless I know that it's going to work. That's just because I'm afraid to fail.
It's
just because I have to know that it's going to a degree, 60% be funny.
Sure.
And then I can gloss over and move on. Then the other, just to quickly leap onto something that I can work on and fail at for a long time. I had it in my idea for a long time of getting a guy up on stage and putting some trousers in front of him with feet, and then making him the legs dance to River Dance. So I wanted that, and then eventually trying to find ways to make a huge row of legs that would all do that. So I spent months working on various pulleys and puppets and rigging things up and chairs. I've got a mannequin in my room that I can kind of strap stuff to. And so I sort of pull.
I'm sure you have.
So I would work on this for so many months doing the stuff until eventually it was like, this is just not... It became too hard. I was really forcing the punchline. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of whittled it all back down to going, what is funny? Legs are funny. Feet are funny. So I went back right to Charlie Chaplin's shoe bread thing, mm-hmm. which was actually from Fatty Arbuckle originally. He lifted it. The shoes, the bread rolls and the forks. And then it was... That turned into a pair of shoes to potato mashers for me. Then it was like, cover those with the trousers, because the trousers were the prop that I was playing with most. And then that became a whole new puppet. and that's now in the second show. Mm-hmm. And then it was that thing of going, because my wife is like the litmus test really for all of my jokes. If she laughs once when I go, this is the idea, if she laughs, I go, that works. Otherwise, I'm going, here's the legs that do this, and then I'm going to do this, and this is it. And she'll just stare at me going, no, this is not funny.
I have a similar thing with my brother. I kind of test jokes on him, and if he's very kind of... not serious, but if he laughs, it's definitely going to work.
It's going to work.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And if he doesn't laugh, it might still work, but if he does laugh, it definitely will.
If my wife smiles, it's amazing.
Right, I've got to say, to be honest, I'm a little bit giddy throughout this one. I think whenever I interview someone that I'm good friends with, I tend to get a bit overexcited, so apologies for that. We're going to go with Sam into a bit of detail on some of the more surprising elements of his creative process, especially his use of music as a starting point, which is something that we've never really covered before on the show. We're going to talk about some of the techniques that Sam has borrowed from the worlds of magic, circus and street performing in order to manipulate his audience, manipulate maybe, too strong a word, maybe. Maybe not. He also animates his audience to a great extent. We'll also discuss his feelings about risk and some of the less obvious techniques through which he chooses volunteers from the crowd. Some fascinating stuff there. Of course, whenever street performers are on the show, we always end up talking at some stage about money and the acquisition thereof. And there's some frankly hilarious marketing techniques mentioned here that are just begging for someone to adapt to free fringe shows. Lovely. I really must start running a course. Thanks for listening. Not much else to say here. Do keep telling people about the show. Join the Facebook group if you like. Tweet me at ComComPod. You can send in your suggestions for guests. It's lovely to notice on Twitter people tweeting other folk and telling them about ComComPod and thanking each other for that recommendation. So that warms my heart. Thank you very much for doing that. I'm going to run a little competition at Christmas, so do me a favour. I've noticed lots and lots of comedians can do really good impressions of other comedians. So if you know a particularly good one, do email me with the act who can do it and who they can do. Just send me just a one-line email to info@comedianscomedian.com, or you can tweet me at ComComPod and just say such and such an act can do a really good impression of such and such another act. I'm only asking for people famous enough that this would work for a competition, please. Both the impressionist and the impressionee have to be recognisable to a regular comedy-going crowd. Send me some of those. That might work. I might try that around Christmas time. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? Have a lovely little laugh at Christmas. And finally, do remember the bleeps at the end of the show are where I've skipped over inaudible audience questions because the audience weren't mic'd. You live and learn. So towards the end of the show, there's a couple of little bips. They're not mistakes. They're just moments where I've bleeped out audience's questions. So there we go. I shall return you now to the wonderful Sam Wills.
Let's talk about this idea that you want to, things have to be 100% reliable. Because it's easy to kind of, in retrospect, it's easy to go, of course you swapped some bouncy stilts for a crossbow plunger.
Yeah.
Because I could never imagine the boy doing a bouncy stilts act because it's too chaotic. It's too random.
Yeah.
And your stuff has that. It's about satisfaction, isn't it? It's about a surprise, verbal jokes. It's about a surprising yet satisfying conclusion.
Yeah.
So the laugh comes when we or the person on stage or we then them or them then us realise what's going on.
Yeah, that penny dropping moment.
Exactly. So it's a sort of a satisfaction kind of which is in a kind of way that's maybe reminiscent of when you're juggling and you nail a trick.
Yeah.
You have to nail the things, don't
every
you?
Time it has you to have be, to land it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So. Go on, you look.
I was just thinking that that's why I am trying to drop all the tricks, and it becomes frustrating when I see something in the show that I'm not in control of. There's a hair dryer. I've got hair dryer issues at the moment.
Yes, I see. That's a lovely bit.
Yeah, if you buy a 2,000 watt hair dryer, it will shoot a ping pong ball this high. But if you buy a 2,200 watt ping pong ball, it goes this high. And they do not make a 2,100 watt ping pong hair dryer.
So
I need it that height. So I'm trying to desperately find ways to make it work, and it doesn't work.
Sure.
So this is why in the show at the moment I'm.
Can you dial the power source somehow so it gets less?
No, don't. No,
it doesn't. I don't understand electricity.
Yeah.
Can you do some sort of spell?
the inconsistency and even the throwing a plunger. Originally the rule was for me that there are no tricks, no talking in the show. That has evolved and changed. Like, I do a couple of tricks in the show.
Sure.
And, like, I throw a plunger, and even then it still doesn't work sometimes.
Yes.
But okay. For me, it has to normally land.
Okay. But is there not, in that example of the hairdryer and the ping pong ball,
yep.
And there's a person, I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but there is a person trying to do something with that ping pong ball, and it takes many goes.
Yeah.
Is that frustrating to you that it takes many goes? Because isn't it also,
we ran out of music.
Okay.
The track's 4 minutes, 17 seconds long. It's a long time to be holding a hairdryer going, hit the ball!
Yeah.
And it's just trying to do it over and over and over. The gag is he's trying to hit a ping pong ball into a golf green that I've kind of built. And he just has to land it once. So you combine the odd factor of a guy who's uncoordinated with a ping pong ball that's varied, and then another guy who's just swinging a thing around. It just becomes this weird thing where I'm a wee bit out of control, but at the same time, I then try and rein it in to go, it's really, really easy. We'll pull everything together.
Are you ever tempted to explore those areas of being out of control?
No.
Okay, that's interesting. Because that bit reminds me of something like Tim Vine's Pen Behind the Ear.
Yeah.
I don't know if people are familiar with that. It's a routine where brilliant one-liner comic Tim Vine, it plays this music that just goes pen behind the ear, pen behind the ear, pen behind the ear.
Amazing.
For a very long time while he tries to throw a pen behind his ear. Misses, and he's got a box of pens, and he's doing it for a very long time.
Yeah.
But part of the joy of that is that it cannot be fixed. He's trying to throw a pen behind his ear, and it doesn't work for a very long time, and then it does work. And
that first part, you know, he's kind of just mucking around, and then you will.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We'll see that face change of I need to end this.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Sure. But that's that routine. I imagine I've not spoken to him about it, but I imagine that routine is sort of about being out of control and needing it to end. I guess in the work that he does, if he's doing a 90-minute stage show and all of his jokes are one-liners, if it does go on for 10 minutes, he can cut some jokes, which is very different. He's quite regimented.
Yeah, for me, the show is so structured with lighting and sound that I have to get it in the right order, and I have to rein it in to a degree. Like, I will have to speed stuff up, but there's, you know, only so much you can do.
I noticed as well, you have a little bin at the back of the stage, like a good street performer, where after each trick, you put the stuff tidy away.
Anyway.
It's almost as if you're expecting, like, oh, Hefty Jeff's on in 2 seconds.
You've got to get off the pitch. That is out of necessity in this show, because normally I would prefer to be able to cover the stage in rubbish, because that in the first show I very much did that. It was just everywhere. Whereas with the second show, and for the finale part of it, it needs to be a reasonably clear stage, otherwise I'll be breaking stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is that thing of how do I clean and clear the stage?
Yeah,
at the same time.
Yeah. And this is anecdotal rather than... interview per se, but I always remember you as a street performer being so sharp and thinking of these things before everyone else. So, I mean, the street performing community is like a hive mind of ideas which people nick from each other and improve. And, you know, it's
like pirates
standing on the shoulders of giants is how it's politely referred to. You know, as soon as someone gets up a 10-foot pole and realizes that's all you need to do to get an audience, the next person will get up a 10-foot pole and juggle fire, and the next person will do it standing on their head.
And a chainsaw on fire.
With a chainsaw on fire. Exactly. It really is. It's chainsaw on fire, up a stick, naked, you cannot fail. But you always are, and the thing that me and Pete Dobbing, a mutual friend of ours, a street performer and comic, the thing that Pete and I used to just go crazy over was when you were hatting your street shows, and you'd say for a paper donation, you get a signed photo.
Yeah, I was very clinical and cynical about my street show. Well, no, actually...
Well, it's not. I don't know if it is cynical. So it was very good marketing.
Yeah, well, the street show, the street performing side of things, when I went from comedy back to street, because I kind of, when I lost the joy of performing on stage for a while, and it's like, well, okay, I'm going to go back to what I enjoyed doing, which I thought was street performing, which I hadn't quite nailed. So it was like, right, I'm going to learn how to be a good street performer. So I looked at my street show and then sat down with my wife, and we overanalyzed it. We just went do every detail of it, and then just started getting into the almost neurolinguistic programming of the whole thing of how to a street show for me is my street show isn't a creative street show. It's a marketing thing of making money because it was going to be my income. I was going to be a professional street entertainer. I had one show a day to make the most amount of money possible out of one audience in 40 minutes. How can I get these people to part with the biggest amount of cash? And so, yeah, the show was based on how can I repeatedly say the number five throughout the show?
Yeah.
And I, you know, doing this, holding up my hand, constantly reminding people in 5 minutes, I'm going to do this, I'm going to give you this and this and this. And then I would be saying, yeah, I even actually managed to say the word pounds through it. Like, and I want, you know, you, the round of applause you gave me a five. This time I want you to give me a 10. And then I want you to give me absolutely everything you've got.
Creepy little magician. This reminds me of Stevie Blades. You know, Steve does the street at the moment.
Yeah.
He had a hammer. And I remember he does a trick where he gets a concrete block broken on his chest. And I remember saying, whatever that hammer weighs, you've got to keep referring to it as the 10-pound hammer. Like, it's going to be like, just say it enough times. Jeez, and I remember Mr. Spin and his crew, they had those shirts, like American baseball shirts.
Yeah.
And the red piping was exact, and they all had number 20. And the red piping of the shirts was exactly the same color red as a $20 Australian bill. Amazing. So this is, there's a bit, you know, he's not the only one out there doing programming the audience. Yeah. But the thing that particularly caught our eye was you, for a paper donation, you get a signed photo.
Because
the signed photo had a badge and your contact details. So you were selling your business card. Oh, come on!
There's that certain excitement that happens around a street show where you want to get something from them. And so, you know, if you've created this whole thing and you go, I've got this thing, you need to give me this and I'll give you this in return.
Yes.
The badges weren't that expensive to make, and the photos were pretty low grade quality. But it was, you know, it was a physical thing. And, you know,
it was a good thing. They wanted it, but you weren't ripping people off.
No,
they wanted to pay for the show.
They also got a joke with it as well, because the joke was they got a signed photo of me pushing my body through a tennis racket, and on the back were the instructions on how you can push your body through a tennis racket. And the instructions were along lines of get a tennis racket, remove strings, push body through, Sam Wills accepts no responsibility for any injury. And then that was it. So it kind of looked like a joke in the show, but it was very much a real sell. It's like, you can buy this. This is for sale. Get this.
Yeah.
And then
people
would come and take it. Yeah.
Let's talk about your notebook. You've brought some bits with you.
Well,
something I ask comics to do on the show is to bring with them their notebook, or more often these days, their note-taking app. And to sort of talk us through, if you have an idea you're thinking about at the moment, to sort of explain what routes you will take to unlock the funny in that idea.
See, what I've got at the moment is I list songs whenever I hear them. So I haven't looked at these for a while. Walking on Sunshine, good song, it says. When a Man Loves a Woman is there. It's just, I've listed songs that I like. When a Man Loves a Woman, Heartbeats is in there. Hero by Enrique Iglesias, good song. So these are my list of bits and pieces.
So let's take Walking on Sunshine. Mm. So there's that song. You listen to the song, and are you already thinking, okay, what can I do on stage that will make this be a punchline?
I would initially be looking for a pun. Walking on Sunshine, so that way that becomes the first joke, or it just becomes about the music and the beat, and then it becomes a moving thing. So it's like, well, what can I do with an audience member? Because again, when I write material, it becomes back to very simple things. Conflict are my main things. Like the second show at the moment is very boysy. It's my nephew's fault as well. I write a lot with him. He's sort of, well, when I say write, he doesn't know. I'm just playing with him and taking all his ideas.
how old is he?
He was 9 when
I
sort of was working on the second show.
Sure.
Yeah. The first show evolved naturally, which was a completely different process to the second show, which is why they are kind of different. First show, when I was writing the material, it was just a listen to a song, find the punchline, and then that would grow into this thing. And And then also accidentally finding the music that would evolve into the jokes. Whereas the second show was very kind of forced. I had 3 months to write the show. Mm-hmm. So it was like, find these. That's why the second show is maybe a wee bit more streety influenced rather than the first show is quite pretty. The second show is more in your face, loud.
Yes, because you also had to scale up to doing a 750 seat venue, yeah, so which you are selling out every night.
Yeah.
five.
So the music is one aspect. If anything, when I'm now writing material, it's like this is probably the best example of that I've got for writing a joke, mm-hmm. where I... And I normally write material when I'm not supposed to, because with the second show, I was kind of forced. I booked into a festival to do an hour-long show called More Tape, and I hadn't written a single joke for it. And there was that terror of, this deadline is here, I have to deliver it, because that's festival wanted me to come back and do
that
it.
That is a good, and that's a very frequent thing I hear, that a good way to make work is to book yourself into something you can't get out of, not do anything for a long time,
Happen where Felicity, my wife, locked me into a room for 6 weeks with a whole bunch of stuff and just went, you have to stay in here and write a show. Mm-hmm. And so I just had my...
She locked you in there with some stuff?
Well, yeah, pretty much. That was it.
I found, look, there's a lawnmower and a cabbage. Just go and don't come out when you've got 5 minutes.
There was the one room in our house that no one was allowed to kind of go into, and they couldn't go into it because it was always messy and horrible, and it was like a child's bedroom. It was just crazy. My mother-in-law walked in there once and just went, I'm not going back in there. And so she walked out, and then I would pop around to the shop and buy my props and go in there and work on these ideas and bits and pieces. And so when I would work on an idea, other times I would have to do something very serious or do the work side of things, taxes. Like, I remember putting aside an entire day to work on my taxes, and that's when the idea pops in. So, because it's now I'm trying to avoid doing this, to go play over here. So then that became the excitement, and that's where this my latest idea, which I've been working on
for the benefit of listeners, Sam is holding a small rubber pig. But he's just done that with his own mouth.
It's a squeezy dog toy pig that I found, and it's always been funny. And originally I used it as a phone, and I would pretend to talk.
Okay.
And then I'd hang up, and that was the gag. And then it was like I was trying to do some normal work, and then Blue Orchid by the White Stripes came on, and it was that repetitive doom, 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 doom throughout it. And I saw the pig, and I thought the pig could be the drum kit. So I was like the pig going... repetitively over and over and over, getting quite boring. But then it was like, okay, how can I make a drum kit? So I went out and bought these flappy hands, the Come On England things, and so then it would build to me. Eventually, the pig would become the kick drum, and then these would become the drumsticks. What? That's funny, and it got a clap and a laugh then.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not funny. It doesn't work. As a joke on stage, I've tried it in 5 shows now, because that's the thing. I say I won't try something on stage unless I know it's funny. I know it's funny to a degree, but the thing is, Blue Orchid is 2 minutes 50 long, and so it's a long time. So I've got to try and then slow the joke down to reveal these eventually and pull the pig out and whatnot. So that becomes...
Let's talk about specifically that, just something you're saying there. You've got to slow the joke down.
Okay, so I do now is the pig, I have to... The pig now becomes a running gag, because I want to introduce the pig to people, so that way when I present it as a kick drum, it's now not a pig anymore, it's a kick drum. But it's not. Otherwise, if I pull it out straight away and start using it as a kick drum, it's a kick drum. That's it. So I now need to show it as a pig. And so I show early on in the set, I go, this is a pig, look at this. And then I just put it away. And then I get on with the show. And then I would normally hold out a shaker, a little wee egg shaker thingy, which I then changed because I realised that the shaker was... too much of a real musical instrument, so that had to be something else. So that changed to a box of crunchy nut cornflakes,
okay,
with a bit of string over it that I would just shake at the audience, and then I'd put it away. So I'm lucky enough that I can be surreal and random throughout the set, where I can stop everything and introduce an element and ignore it and just go, I know what this is. Okay, we'll move on. And then to slow it down at the very end, when I want to make it work, for 2 minutes 50, I would then, the music would come in, I would start feeling as though, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. And then I'd realise, then I have that penny dropping moment where, oh, I know what needs to happen. I pull the pig out, and then the pig starts honking, then that's the... that's the joke for them initially. Mm-hmm. So now I'm just squeezing a pig for the first sort of minute, staring at an audience going, this is great fun kind of thing. And then I have to get bored with it, which was, again, an incredibly frustrating thing to watch. The opening ceremony of the Olympics, because I got sent a link of Mr. Bean doing, because I'm not the biggest Mr. Bean fan, but everyone thinks I am because I don't talk. But he did the Chariots of Fire thing with the piano, where and as he was just getting bored doing that one note, all I could think was, 2 years I've been working this pig. Where I get bored with a pig, so I'm hoping that he'll slowly, that bit will vanish, and then people won't think, oh, you saw Mr. Bean do that, and you were
I think only you in your head could possibly make that connection.
And then, so once I've got the pig, sort of, I get bored with the pig and then put away, and then the music will then drive the action. So the music has the hi-hats in it, which then bring out the crunchy nut cornflakes, which then, so the audience make the connection, the crunchy nut cornflakes are now the hi-hat. So I bring those out, and then it comes back to the pig. So the music goes from hi-hats to back to that boring drum beat. So it's like, yay, we've got something different. And then it's like, no, we don't. We're back to the norm again. So that gets another laugh.
Sure.
So it's repetitiveness, the idea that I'm going to do this. Again, like pen behind the ear, this is going to keep going for the whole song.
Yes.
And then the hands come out as the song, and because the song does build with energy, so then the hands come out, and I hold back because I put my fingers under one half of them, so you only get the initial sort of half. You can choose to get a full clap, or when you put your finger under it, you just get that.
Okay.
So that makes the initial kind of, everyone goes, oh, yay, he's made drumsticks.
Yeah.
And then as the music builds and builds and builds, then there's that frenetic moment, and then I fall back to a street performing thing of getting everyone to clap, because I can do that with the hands. Everybody claps, which builds the energy, and then we just go nuts with that, and then lights will come in. Lighting is the other thing that I use a lot in jokes to create the punchline and the energy.
Sure.
So for me, that's how a joke will work. I'll take that basic pig squeaky thing and try and drag that out to a 3-minute thing.
Okay.
dragging it out makes it sound even worse.
Let's talk then about the way you use audience members, because that's obviously, to my mind, that has a rich tradition of in street performing, taking people out of the audience, animating them. I mean, I think we, I don't know when exactly chronologically you became a street performer, but I'm sure we have a lot of the same contemporaries, people like Anthony Livingspace and Pepe and Herbie Treehead. Some of these are available on the Royal Mile. If you like, look out for Anthony Livingspace. He's in town and he's a fantastic clown.
Good.
He's just so good, so good. Something that they do it's not quite fair to sort of lump all of those three together, but they do three very different approaches to getting people from the audience to do things.
Yep.
And from a juggler's perspective, we know getting a guy out and making him do some pseudo alpha male stuff and getting a laugh at his expense, that's kind of like the cheapest possible version of it. Something you do with audience members is you have a lot of, there's a thing set up which maybe we can see and they can't, or we can see we have a different perspective and they don't.
Yeah.
So the moment is waiting for them to catch on.
Yeah.
That's quite different, isn't it? I've not really seen much.
No, but at the same time, I also don't want to embarrass, because I was chosen as a volunteer once in a show by a street performer and just embarrassed solidly for 15 minutes as I tied him into a straitjacket, and it was horrible.
Wow.
And then from there, I even then became that street performer who would do that alpha male routine of getting people out doing these things.
Sure. Can we just, I have a cast iron technique for not being chosen as a volunteer in a street show. If you'd be interested, if you're watching a street show and someone says, can you help us, just look them in the eye and go, I'm a street performer, and they'll go, oh, sorry mate, like that, and move on. Just keep that to yourselves.
So my way of working with volunteers is I don't want them to be embarrassed on stage, and that's why in the show they've got the tiniest responsibility. Normally they have to do one job or stand somewhere or hold something. So to a degree I am treating audience members like props. They are just coming up and helping hold a prop or do a thing or have a role, because also that comes back to the risk thing. I don't want them to have a responsibility, because if they have a responsibility, they could ruin the show. So that's the thing. I've written the show that they have to do this thing to make this happen, but it's a tiny thing, and if they get it wrong, I'll replace them with somebody else who'll do it.
Okay.
I also don't want to replace them because I want everyone to be successful. I want the audience to like each other.
Yes, that's it. No one ever looks embarrassed in your show. Well, they might go, oh, you know, here we are. But it's kind of like surface stuff. Yeah. No one has ever left.
No, because I think that's really horrible to watch. You don't really want to watch somebody on stage having that awkward, oh, I hate being here, because then everyone doesn't want to be here. Mm-hmm. And also, the moment somebody says no on stage, then everyone has the right to say no straight away, which is always bad. So when working through the first show, it was the idea of how can I get people to be comfortable on stage and enjoying that moment. And then it grew. I suppose your example of the perspective thing, there's one part in the show where I get audience member to stand on stage and all I want them to do is grab a microphone. And what's happened is I've put the microphone just slightly to his right in front of him, but to the audience's point of view, it's right in front of him. And then I purposefully will do an action that to an audience looks like grabbing a microphone, but it's closer to my body, so it's not right for him. So that way he gets confused.
Deliberate. That's almost like a magical technique, a stage magic technique. Yeah. You're appearing to give him very clear instructions whilst deliberately giving him confusing instructions so that he doesn't do it.
He gets it slightly wrong. He's doing the right action. I'll get frustrated
but
with
he
him.
Doesn't but understand he doesn't the understand the connection.
The audience start making the responses and the noise. So he's going, why are they laughing at me doing this? This is just, I'm copying him. I'm getting it right. And then eventually it builds to the moment he touches that microphone, it's the success. He's done it. Sure. He's got it right.
At which point the audience presumably go ballistic.
Absolutely nuts. Yeah. So there are those moments of wanting to control the audience, but at the same time, I'm wanting him to succeed, but I'm leading him down a path to get there.
Sure.
But I'm not wanting to embarrass him. I'm not going, oh, you're getting it wrong.
Yeah. Do you think that because you're leading him down a specific path, there is also... maybe there is a limit to what that audience member can do in your show. If he or she is sort of a prop, effectively, then maybe they don't have the opportunity to do something unexpected.
Yes and no, because they come up on stage, I've got the set job for them, which I want them to do, and then 9 times out of 10, my objective is to get them up, do the job, and get on to the next bit because the show is locked and lighting and sound. Occasionally, they'll do something that is just amazing. It's like then it's frustrating because my job then for the next 3 or 4 nights is trying to recreate that moment,
trying to re-engineer that and incorporate it into the. Okay.
There was one routine in the first show, the stripper one, where the guy accidentally put his leg through the armhole, and so when he pulled it up, the strap was going through. So it was a great confusion. So it's like, this is great. So then I spent the next day working out how I could hold the trousers so when I put them on him, I was slipping it through his leg.
Okay.
And then I'd step away, so then it would look like he had got it wrong, but I'd set him up. But okay. I wasn't, it was that thing of going, you've failed, but you haven't failed. We're confused. It's okay. We can fix this.
Sure.
And it was awkward.
Okay.
But funny.
Fantastic. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've a few minutes left. If you've any questions for Sam, you can say them through me, and I'll just, for the sake of recordings, repeat them. There's a gentleman down here. So you start off this, your current show, sitting on stage as everyone walks in.
I will start all my shows, and the full hour-long shows, I always start sitting on stage, because the reason is I want to have people get used to what I look like with tape on my face. Because some people are turning up the show going, you know, what is it? How can it work? So when I want the audience to go, this is what I look like. I have tape on my face. This is what you're going to be watching for the next hour. You can relax. And I also use that time to pick all of my volunteers.
This is the kind of secret we wanted to know.
So I will memorize where every person will be for the entire show.
What do you look for in a volunteer? How do you pick?
The first...
so that everyone here can wear a yellow hat, which I would never choose.
What I'm really enjoying about the second show is that people are turning up expecting a certain thing. My first volunteer comes from the back row, which is really fun because everyone...
Yes, that's lovely, because you step towards the front and everyone goes, here we go, and then you go past them.
When I look for volunteers, I normally look for couples, because some couples will come in and watch a show and they will sit there for 15 minutes. Normally I'm sitting for about 15 minutes. They'll sit there 15 minutes looking straight ahead and they won't talk to each other. They won't look at each other, and it's so odd, but it's really weird. And then you get another couple come in who are just they touch each other. They sort of mirror each other and everything. And you go, if I choose one of them, the other one is going to be incredibly supportive which will then drive an audience. And then when you see packs of guys come in, like when I choose a stripper volunteer, it'll be from choosing a pack of boys normally. And then I will choose to, do I pick the alpha male who then the others are going to go, we support, or I try and nail the second in command of the group, because then the alpha male in the audience will encourage the others sitting around him to clap and cheer at his second in command, okay, which will then drive the audience to clap and cheer.
Sure.
And then the second in command guy on stage won't want to let down, otherwise he loses his position in the group.
So take several mates and make sure you're the runt. That's the...
And then sometimes I will just be looking for somebody who's wearing a plain black t-shirt, because for one puppet in the first show I need to be able to gaffer tape white, so it needs to visually look clear. So sometimes you might just be wearing the wrong thing, and that's about it. And then other times it's just, you know, body size and hairstyle and things like that. The other interesting thing is that I recently just got laser eye surgery done.
Oh, yeah.
So I can now finally see my audience.
Oh, no.
Because I have had a couple of accidents where I've chosen wrong volunteers.
Okay.
You know, some people look quite androgynous nowadays.
Sure.
And when you're gaffer taping somebody's nipples, it's important to know if they're a man or a woman.
Me and Noel did an entire show outside Bourke Street Mall in Melbourne, you know, the old post office before it burnt down, where we had a volunteer on stage and we didn't know their gender, and Noel had to do a sort of acrobatic stunt jumping over them, and we kept going, so what's your name? And they'd go, Bernie. And you go, of course it is. And I just go, okay, can we edit it? Wonderful. So any other questions? Was that gentleman down here? So just was that the reason that you brought some people up in a show last year, got the big cheer and sent them away?
No, that was just a running callback gag of a guy who I wanted to... He would always be the callback guy who would have a big success at the end. He was the star of the show. So the idea was to introduce him as a prop early on, present him, and then go, right, that's your role, get lost.
Get rid of him.
Get rid of him. And then it would also put the audience to a degree at ease, because it was like, he came up, he just stood there, he got a round of applause, and now he's gone. And that was it. So he didn't do anything and he got a round of applause. So it's almost like going, this is a safe space. Look at what he got. He didn't do anything.
Gotcha.
And then we'll move on. And then I'd come back to him a few times in the show. But then at the very end of the show, there was that feeling of the show hasn't been completed until that guy has been used for something. And then he would be used for the biggest and visual finale of it all.
Sure. Any others? So, yeah. Do audiences differ much around
the
world?
No, the audiences are pretty much the same. I'm lucky that I don't have to change anything that I do, because the music I'm using is so international and I don't have any modern references. The show that I did last year, which was the first Boy with Tape on His Face, I've been doing that show since 2005. So that's been touring for 7 years, and it's exactly the same show from 7 years. It's never changed. Once it's written, boom, it's done. And so I would travel with that, and audiences... always the same sort of response. We've done shows in Norway where the people would just, you know, the whole show was in Norwegian, and then I'd come on and do my spot, and I would just listen for the boy with tape on his face. That's my cue, go. And then, yeah.
A situation where, like, it turns out that the film Ghost wasn't popular in Norway, so now you're just molesting a woman and everyone looks at you.
No, I've been pretty lucky. We've been... If anything, it makes me aware of trying to be international, because I want the show to be able to go everywhere. One of the first reasons for working on a silent show as well was because I wanted to go to Japan, but I was too lazy to learn the language, hence...
The lazy boy with tape on his face. Yeah. So just to finally then, just before we wrap up in about 2 minutes, what's next? Given that you've now created a show which is scalable to 750, I mean, what's the biggest venue you've played so far?
Royal Albert Hall was probably the biggest. That was 7,000.
Wowzers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty huge.
Pretty huge. And that was a success there. So what's next? I mean, do you keep infinitely scaling venues, or what's the next project? What's the next thing?
I want the show to evolve. If anything, my problem is that I always want to change the rules and not do what people expect. So if I do another show, which I probably will, I might do a smaller show, if anything. I feel like the second show has been very boysy. The first show was really nice to introduce the character. The second show is very boysy because it was lots of gunfights, Star Wars fights, and things like that. Third show, I think it might be a wee bit more sweet and love-based, and so I might scale it right back. So I was thinking, you know, a tiny little 100-seater where everyone can see and just do really small stuff, which would be really, really nice. Or the other option is to completely break the format and change it completely, because everyone at the moment thinks, you come along, you sit in the audience, I get people up, and we do that, and blah, blah. So an idea on my notebook at the moment is dinner with Tapeface. So the idea of 100 people come and seeing a show where I will choose 6 people, sit them around a table, and then I will make a meal. And then this concept of somebody with no mouth feeding people I quite like. And so and then I like the idea of also blinding, to a degree, blinding the people on stage so they can't see the audience. So then they lose that feeling of I'm being watched. So then they just get the reactions of each other. Mm. Because, I don't want people to go, I'm coming along to see a show, getting this, and a big finale. Boom. Mm-hmm. So I changed the rules a wee bit. But, and then the next step, I suppose, that'd be one project. Where I'd like to take it would be West End. It's always been my dream. I'd love to do a full, big West End show. Like I love the idea of having a set. Because at the moment, my set is just cardboard boxes and rubbish. But in my brain, I can picture, huge houses and rooms and stuff and things, a wall that sings. My biggest dream is to walk on stage, opening gag, walk on stage and have the house do the falling
climb. Oh, lovely. Yes, that would be great.
And that would reveal the rooms that we'd be going into. And when you do West End shows, they're always like the 3 levels. I'd love to have ramps that go from the stage up to the middle levels and then get up to the third. So that way there's that feeling of you could be involved no matter where you are.
Even if you're in the Royal Box, even if you're in the Royal Box, zip wire
you can come down. Yeah, yeah. There's ways, yeah.
Happy days.
And then also because of music being the next thing, it's I'd love to get like the horn section. I'm doing a spot for them, which is I did a spot for them last year, so they play the music live on stage as I do the stuff. And so when I first did that spot, it was like, this is amazing. This changes. It changes the whole feeling and tone of it. So to create a Tapeface band of kind of dirty
musicians with their hands tied together.
I don't know. Well, for some reason, I think there was a homeless guy in Auckland who I used to give a lot of money to because he was amazing. He was a clarinet player and he could play the most incredible clarinet, but he always looked like he was covered in his own shit and vomit and whatnot. But he would sit there and just play this beautiful clarinet. It was really, really nice. But so, a band made out of completely people of that kind of homelessy, trampy style would be quite nice.
French, obviously.
French.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, when are you doing the horn section? Just out of interest.
No idea.
Okay,
no
so look out on the horn section for when Sam's going to be there. That's all we've got time for. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking Mr. Sam Wills? Thanks, man.
And I'm very pleased to tell you that Sam has achieved another one of his goals there with a West End run now happening at the Duchess Theatre in London from the 17th of December until the 5th of January 2013. You can get tickets online through his website, which is, of course, www.theboywithtapeonhisface.com. Thanks to Sam for being on the show. Thank you all for your feedback. Remember, if you'd like to see me do stand-up at a gig somewhere, you can follow the link to my own site from comedianscomedian.com or go straight there, which is stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, and look at the calendar page, the gigs page there to see where I'm on. Thank you to BBC Worldwide for their support. Thank you to Graham Crockford and Toby Rose, as ever. Hello to Owly. And I'll speak to you lot again next week. Cheerio.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.